Hello, it's Monday, June the 14th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is the Andrew Pearce Show, coming as ever from the Daily Mail newsroom. Diamonds are a girl's best friend, and a boy's, I think, in these gender modern work world. But did you know you can buy them cheaper if they're made in a laboratory? Also, we'll be talking about triumph on the soccer pitch for England, disaster on the cricket pitch for England. It's the fourth anniversary today of Grenfell Tower, that hideous blaze which killed 72 people, and still thousands of tenants of high-rise blocks are still living in exactly the same cladding. I'm talking to the owner of 11 London venues about the failure of the Prime Minister to press ahead with the latest stage of the lifting of the lockdown. And on that subject, a leading GP tells me why she thinks continuing the lockdown does far more damage to the nation's health than lifting it. So Boris Johnson will reveal the worst kept secret in Whitehall and Westminster today when he confirms that we're going to have to be a bit more patient because the easing of lockdown restrictions on June 21st, so-called Freedom Day, simply isn't going to happen. He's delaying it for up to 4 weeks. The Prime Minister is using a press conference at 6 p.m. at Downing Street to set out the delay as the government tries to hit its target of giving all adults at least one dose of a vaccination by the end of next month. Prime Minister wants us all to be patient. Well, I'm going to talk to somebody now who's not very patient about the lockdown. That's Dr. Rennie Hondekamp, who's a London GP and medical writer, and has penned a very powerful piece in the paper today about why delaying the lockdown is a mistake. Dr. Rennie, thanks for joining us. Can you recap why you think the Prime Minister is making such a blunder here?
Yes, of course, Andrew, and hello. So I've worried, as you know, for the last 15 months that the damage that the lockdown is doing to people's health, both physically and mentally, is worse than the cure itself, the lockdown. And that's because I've seen it day in and day out, from mental health through to physical health, cancelled operations, delayed cancer treatments and diagnosis, and the list is endless. And I also worry that this is just a creep where they push us so far into summer that because we're dealing with a seasonal virus, we'll be so close again to autumn that it will actually never end and we will be in lockdown now until next spring. And those are my real concerns.
I'm not sure that politically he could survive a lockdown till next spring, Dr. Rennie. I think his backbenchers would turn on him. But in your view, I mean, aren't you supposed to be concerned as a GP by the spread of the Indian variant or the Delta variant, whatever stupid name they've given it? I mean, are you seeing many more cases of COVID in your surgeries?
Okay, so two answers to that, Andrew. As a doctor, I'm supposed to be concerned about people's health above everything else, and that's what I am concerned about. What I am seeing in my GP surgery are people who are destroyed by lockdowns, who are mentally on the floor, children who are traumatised, people who I can't tell when they'll get their knee surgery. It could be 2 years. And that's my real concern. In terms of COVID in London, I have not seen anyone who might have a COVID case in, I'd say, nearly 2 months now. We're not seeing COVID. We're not seeing this rapid rise. And if people are getting it, they're certainly not getting ill enough to call their GP.
And isn't there evidence too, Dr. Rennie, that those people who are going to hospital with COVID, they're much younger than the first and second waves. They're therefore in hospital for a much shorter space of time. And the death toll from COVID is often now anywhere between single figures and 20. I think more people are dying of influenza every week than are of COVID at the moment.
Absolutely, and that's been the case now for quite a few weeks. And yes, people who are going to hospital, and let's bear in mind, Andrew, that hospitalisation increases has actually gone up by about 1.7%. So it's a very small uptick in hospitalisations. It's younger, fitter people, and as you say, they're actually either not needing to stay in hospital or only staying for one or two nights. So we've now got to a situation where we can live with this. And of course, we don't want anyone to be sick, but we don't want anyone to be sick of anything in an ideal world. But sadly, they are. You know, 1,600 people a day dying in the UK from something, and not many of them from COVID. We have to do what Chris Whitty said and learn to live with this horrible disease.
Yeah, and I heard Edward Argar, one of the health ministers today, responding to what Chris Whitty said, the chief medical officer, and he said, well, look, we are mindful of the damage to the economy and businesses and people's mental health. And he denied the government was trying to achieve an almost zero COVID situation. But you do wonder if that's what their objective is.
So I do wonder, and I think it's one of a few things. I wonder if the scientists who want zero COVID, and there are plenty of them, are really running the agenda. And that's nonsense. That's never going to happen. I mean, what people don't talk about very often is the Indian or Delta variant, whatever you'd like to call it, is in Australia. And Australia have closed borders, and they cannot link those variants to anyone who's come in and been in quarantine because it's a variant. It will evolve wherever. The fact that it started in India is just where it started. We will have evolved our own Indian variant come what may. That's number one. Number two, I think there is something else going on. I know there are 10 to 20% of vulnerable people. So people that have blood cancers, immunosuppressed, renal dialysis, very, very elderly, who do not get protection from the vaccines. And we know this. If you look at Kidney Care UK's website, they tell their dialysis patients that only one in five of them will not get protection from the vaccine. Nicola Mendelsohn, the CEO of Facebook, has a blood cancer and has spoken out that she has not got any antibodies from both vaccines. My son's father-in-law is a dialysis patient. He doesn't have any. I think the government know this. They're worried about it, understandably, because we don't want people to die, nor do I. And so instead of having an honest conversation with the public where they say, listen, we've done our best. We've really had this fantastic vaccine rollout. But there are a few of you who are not going to be protected. Let's give you all an antibody test so we know who you are. And then if you want to stay shielding and you want protection from the government, you want finance from the government to help you, we will do that. But the rest of the people who are not going to die from COVID need to be able to get on with their lives. That, for me, would be the most honest conversation they could have, and it would allow the country to get back to normal. It would make the ongoing damage to physical and mental health.
Very interesting stuff. That's Dr. Rennie Hondekamp, a London GP. Do read her piece in the Mail today. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to the Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. Britain's nightclubs have been shut for 15 months, and the delay to the so-called Freedom Day means they're going to be remaining closed for weeks longer. Charlie Gilkes is the founder of Inception Group, the owner of 11 London venues, and he's now suggesting that nightclubs now will need more help with business rates and furlough payments. And he joins me now. Charlie, every time I seem to speak to you, we think we're on the cusp of you getting your clubs open again, and then we know the Prime Minister's going to push you back again. If you don't get financial help, are you in big trouble, putting it bluntly?
I mean, I'm looking forward to have a conversation with more positive news. But no, for us, I mean, we're lucky in the sense that I have a mixture of bars, restaurants, and only one nightclub. Some of the venues are currently viable, but still trading at a significantly reduced turnover to how they were pre-COVID, because our capacities have been reduced by about 40% in aggregate. But you know, for our nightclub, it's really, really testing. And you know, there are groups of businesses around the UK which are purely nightclub operators. You know, they have 20, 30, or even a single, really, really hard. I mean, speaking to Kate Nichols earlier, the chief executive of UK Hospitality, you know, it's going to cost the sector £3 billion in lost revenue over the next month, and 900 premises are at risk of closing altogether. 170,000 people are still on full furlough. So more definitely needs to be done.
And it's interesting, isn't it, Charlie, because you will have seen images, I'm sure, of those political leaders at the G7 summit having their barbecue on the beach in Carbis Bay. Not a heed to any social distancing whatsoever, and yet your businesses still have to operate with social distancing, which is why some of them are presumably running at a financial loss.
It's very frustrating, you know, when I consider in one of our venues approached us because someone was standing up before going to the loo and told us we must ask that person to sit down, and you know, he was literally just on his way to the loo, and we've really been working really, really hard to take all the rules really, really seriously. But yes, it is a real kick seeing the leaders enjoying You know, watching the red arrows fly past very close proximity, without the care in the world. And also, it's frustrating that this Delta variant is in the country due to, you know, the Prime Minister trying to seek out a trade deal with India and not putting on the red list when he should have. So I think hospitality has carried the can a lot. You know, you pile into to a tube, and then as soon as you get to the... I know these politicians face very difficult choices, and I just hope that actually if they are going to delay us, this really is the final heave. This isn't yet more weeks of uncertainty and months of uncertainty, and that they bring us proper support. And that needs to include business rates and being wavered in their entirety. That's been done for all devolved administrations in Northern Ireland, in Wales and in Scotland, but not for operators in England. That really needs to happen.
Well, that's a very interesting point, and it's a point we'll put to ministers when we talk to them. That's Charlie Gilkes, who's founder of the Inception Group, the owner of 11 London venues, with making the very salient point that there should be assistance for business rates in England like there is in other parts of the UK. Thanks for joining us. OK, why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces and more. You can get in touch by tweeting us at mailplus or me at Tory Boy Pierce. So today is the fourth anniversary of that horrific fire at the Grenfell Tower in London, in which 72 people lost their lives. And yet, 4 years on, shockingly, thousands of people are still living in blocks of flats with exactly the same cladding, work still yet to start in 36 blocks with ACM cladding and other blocks where the work has only barely started. Grenfell survivors have accused the government of playing Russian roulette with people's lives. I'm joined now by Liam Spender, who's from the End Our Cladding Scandal campaign. Liam, none of us will ever forget the images of that tower block ablaze. Did you really think that 4 years on, that the same cladding, which was the trigger for that fire, people would still be living with it on their own tower blocks?
No, I don't think I ever imagined 4 years later we'd still be dealing with this. And I mean, today is a tragic anniversary. The fact that we're still dealing with it is shameful.
And I'm just looking at the figures. The latest government figures, Liam, show 217 of high-rise residential buildings which have ACM cladding have not been fixed yet. Work's underway, with work still to start on 36 blocks. So we could be still several years away from this being resolved.
Absolutely, yes, you're right, Andrew. And it's not just ACM cladding, it's the thousands, literally thousands of buildings with non-ACM cladding and with other fire safety issues. Is this could be around for decades at the snail's pace we're proceeding.
And it's right, isn't it, that many flats that have identified other fire safety defects have left leaseholders facing bills, some of them up to £100,000 each, through no fault of their own.
Absolutely. It's unfortunately the impression the government's giving is that it's washed its hands of it. It keeps touting a number, which admittedly is a large number, £5 billion. But it says, well, that's, you know, that's as much as we're willing to spend on this. The rest will fall on leaseholders, which simply isn't good enough.
The government's made, what, £5 billion available, Liam? How much the figure I keep hearing is three times more than £5 billion is required to get this problem sorted.
Yes, that's the Select Committee, the Housing Communities Local Government Select Committee figure, which is, I think, 2 years old now. They estimated £15 billion. I mean, whether it's £15 billion, some estimates run to £100 billion. It depends what you include and which buildings you target. But anyway you cut it, £5 billion is a drop in the bucket.
And of course, last month, as you know, there was a fire in an East London block still fitted with Grenfell style cladding. Three people were hospitalised, dozens treated for smoke inhalation. And apparently the removal of the cladding had been delayed in a dispute between the builder and the leaseholder over who should pay. And yet lives could have been lost again here.
Absolutely, yes. It's that New Providence Wharf where the fire was is just up the road from where I live, and I've been to see the fire damage, and it's when you see the smoke and the flame damage on the building, you can see how they were they were seconds from disaster, which I think the London Fire Brigade report picked up as well. Their report into the fire said, you know, minutes later and the entire thing could have gone up. And what if it had happened at night in the same way it happened at Grenfell?
Absolutely.
It's terrible.
And the survivors and families of the bereaved are marking the anniversary today by lighting up churches around London in a green glow.
Yes. And I think church bells are ringing 72 times in honour of the sadly departed who were victims of the fire.
Classy, just finally, Liam, are you frustrated also that nobody's been held civilly or criminally accountable for the disaster that was Grenfell Tower?
Frustrated is putting it mildly. I mean, I appreciate the wheels of justice turn slowly and they grind fine. But 4 years on, you'd have thought we should have been much closer to accountability than we seem to be. We seem to be a million miles away from it. I'd hope that's something that can be addressed.
All right, that's Liam Spender. He's from the End Our Cladding Scandal campaign. Thanks for joining us. Deputy Sports Editor Matt Gatwood's here, and it's a tale of two Englands, Matt, isn't it? Joy of joys on the soccer pitch against Croatia, but no joy on the cricket pitch.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we could start with the good news or the bad news. I mean, let's get the bad news out of the way. Well, England were worse than bad on the cricket pitch over the last few days. They were put out of their misery yesterday when they finally lost the second test match to New Zealand and lost the series 1-0. The first time they've lost a home series under Joe Root. The first time they've lost a home series against New Zealand since 1999. And it was really one of the darkest days over recent times for English cricket. They were abysmal in this test match. You've got to remember, this New Zealand team rested six players. They changed six players because they've got the World Test Championship coming up, which starts on Friday against India. So it was almost like a New Zealand second string playing in obviously our conditions, English conditions, and they hammered us by eight wickets. It was a miserable performance all round. Some of the batting was appalling. That's where the real blame lies, in the batsmen rather than the bowlers who you know, kept up their end of the bargain. But the batting was just abysmal. And it shows there's a real lack of sort of strength in depth for this batting team. The pressure seems to be getting to Joe Root, who batted poorly as well. But some of the techniques and some of the way some of these guys play in this England team just don't hold up to scrutiny when you get a good bowling attack against them.
So will they need to have a sort out and kick some of the players out for the next test?
It'll be interesting. So there's a bit of a gap now till they play India in a five-test series, which is going to be huge. It's going to be so important for the future of this particular team and for the captain in Joe Root, for the coach in Chris Silverwood, and looking ahead to the Ashes in the winter. Now, you know, this team's almost been so obsessed by the Ashes that they're not dealing with what's in front of them. So they do need to just concentrate on winning this India series and playing some good cricket, and then the Ashes will sort of take care of itself. But it is going to be a huge series. Now, whether they kick this lot out and bring new ones in, I'd be surprised, because there aren't that many knocking down the door to get into the team. So they sort of think they've got the best players in the team. But some of them need to change their techniques. They need to learn how to bat properly in conditions where, you know, you might have to dig in for a little bit, or where you need to play with a straight bat. You know, I could get quite technical, but I won't. But some of the performances, some of the way they're batting just are never going to work in Test match cricket. So whether they kick some of these out, whether they get rid of a couple and bring a couple of people in, but as I say, there's no one hammering on the door. So maybe that this lot need to pull their socks up.
Sounds like it. But a good performance by England. Well, I don't know if it was a good performance, but they won, which is the main thing. And Matt, am I right that we don't normally ever win our first game in the European Championships?
We've never won our first game in the
really?
European Championships
right.
until yesterday. So so that's a much better start than we've ever made before. And yeah, it was a decent performance. It wasn't, you know, they weren't sensational. But they did the job, you know, as we've never got a win, as you say, in the first game before. Frankly, however it came, really, was the sort of mantra. And also the fact that they've had such a rocky build-up, as we've talked about before, in terms of not being able to play the first to 11 together, even in any of the warm-up games. So the fact they got over the line in terms of getting this first game done and a win, was crucial. So, yeah, I'm not too bothered about the fact they weren't brilliant. They got it done. They were pretty tight at the back, which is an area of the team that a lot of people were worried about. So defensively, they were pretty good. They limited Croatia to just two shots on target. So that was a pretty good effort. And it was brilliant. And an unsung hero in a guy called Calvin Phillips, who started in midfield. And when a lot of people saw the team sheets handed in, they were like, oh, why is he playing? And he absolutely was man of the match, had a brilliant game. He's a Leeds United midfielder, not particularly well known. Obviously, if this tournament had been a year ago, when it should have been, he wouldn't have been in the team. But he's come had a great season for Leeds and got himself into the team. And he set up the goal for Raheem Sterling and gave a brilliant all-round performance. So it was great. It was a good win. It was a good win. They can build on it. They go into Scotland, who they play on Friday night, and at least they've got the confidence of a victory behind them.
And just finally, Matt, remind me, did Croatia knock us out of another tournament?
They did. They beat us in the World Cup, in the semi-final, in the last World Cup, 3 years ago, when they got to the final and lost to France. But they beat us 2-1. If you remember, we went 1-0 up and everyone thought, you know, got really excited. And then they came back into it and beat us 2-1. So so we owed them one.
Certainly did.
Yeah, but if you'd asked me which one I'd rather have won, it would have been the World Cup semi-final. But there we go. We can't turn back time.
Exactly. And now your colleague Tim has given his tip for who's going to be in the final. I haven't asked you your tips who's going to be in the final. I'll give you, let you into a secret, Matt. Not a secret, yeah. But he did not put England in the final too.
He didn't put England in the final too?
No.
Well, that's probably very wise. I mean, so, right, you want me to predict who's going to be in the final?
And I'll immediately go down to the bookies and do the opposite.
Yeah, I know you will, but I'll bet I do. I'll go for France and Portugal.
And how far do you think England will go? Do they have to play the winners of the death squad? Is that what it's called?
The group of death.
The group of death.
Yeah. Well, if they win their group, then they could very well end up playing Germany or France in the first knockout game, which is pretty unfortunate that that group is so strong. So you never know, though. I mean, you know, there's a long way to go in all these groups, and you just don't know how it's going to pan out. But that is the way that if you were sort of looking at it and plotting who should beat who, you know, you would say that if England win the group, they'll have a tough game in the next round. But, you know, as they always say, if you're going to win it, you've got to beat whoever you come up against.
That's Deputy Sports Editor Matt Gatwood with all the latest. Thanks for that. And, of course, the Daily Mail will be covering the European Championships, the Euros, call it what you will, extensively on our sports pages, as we will here on the podcast. Now, if you want to get in touch, tweet us at Mail Plus or me at Tory Boy Pierce. So could laboratory-grown diamonds be the next big thing in the jewellery industry? Apparently they can be made in weeks, sold for a third of the price, and are identical chemically, physically and optically to natural diamonds. And the lab-grown diamond industry is expected to grow by 22% a year. The jewellery founder Laura Chavez said she started receiving poisonous letters when she founded her lab-grown diamond company, Larkin Berry, in 2018. Laura, would the letters potentially, or do you suspect, came from your commercial rivals?
Actually, I know one of the letters that we got actually came from two important people in the jewelry industry. So jewelry and diamonds, so they were signed. And it was just people that had been working with mine diamonds for a long time. And I feel it was just a way to try to intimidate us.
And can you explain how a laboratory diamond is created?
Yes. So there's currently two methods in which you can grow diamonds. One, you basically grab carbon, you put it in a big machine, you apply heat and pressure, immense heat and pressure, and then the diamond starts to grow. So that's just like a super simplified version of that one. And that's called high pressure, high temperature. And then you have another method, which is CVD, chemical vapor deposition, which is where you grab a slice of diamond, you put it inside another type of machine, and you apply immense heat from the bottom, and some natural gases go around it, and the diamond starts forming. So that's also a simplified version of this. But those are the two main methods.
And is this a fairly new phenomenon, or have we had lab diamonds for many years? It's just that they're now starting to take off.
So we've had diamonds. We've been growing diamonds the first one that was grown was, I think, 100 years ago, but they couldn't really replicate the process. And then around the 50s, GE actually started growing diamonds, but they weren't of great quality. So they were just used for industrial purposes. So it's not until maybe, you know, 7-10 years that the quality started to actually become gemological grade quality. And that's why just in the past few years, we've been able to introduce these into fine jewelry.
And you can grow them in your factories over 1 to 4 weeks. When they're finished, they can be cut and polished and look as just as exquisite as a natural diamond.
Yes, I mean, they're the exact same diamond, basically. So there's no difference between them. It's just they grow in a different way. But the diamond is the same. I mean, it just depends on how you cut it and polish it.
I guess, too, also, for people who want to be environmentally friendly, Laura, these are a huge advantage because it means you're not employing miners, often on low wages, in unsafe conditions. The mining can destroy all sorts of natural habitats. You're not inflicting any damage on nature.
No, you're not. And actually, a lot of labs now, I don't know if a lot yet, but many labs are starting to switch over to renewable energy to grow their diamonds. There's even some labs that are doing 100% renewable energy. And there's this new lab that's in the UK that can actually grow diamonds from carbon it grabs from the sky. So that's, I would say, even a negative carbon option.
Yeah. And the big advantage as well, I suppose, Laura, they look the same. They're not as old as natural diamonds, of course. But I imagine they're cheaper to buy, not as expensive, perhaps, is a better way to phrase it.
Yeah. So you can get them anywhere from, I would say, 30 to 50% less. And I mean, you still need labs and you need scientists. And, you know, there's a lot of cost that goes into making diamonds. And then after you grow them, you still have to go through the cutting and polishing process, which also adds to the cost. But yes, they're definitely much less expensive.
People buy them. I mean, where do Lark and Berry sell their diamonds?
We have finished jewelry. So we sell in online. And then we also have our own shop in Marylebone. So only a few blocks from Selfridges. And we sell anything from, you know, we sell small earrings, piercings, all the way to engagement rings. We do a lot of red carpet pieces as well that have been worn in all sorts of awards.
It sounds great. I think I might have to go and have a look. Marylebone's a lovely place to go and visit at the best of times. And do you practice what you preach? Are you wearing one of your diamonds as we speak?
Yes, I'm always wearing something Lark and Berry. That's the only jewelry I wear, actually. So
right. What have you got on today? Is it a ring?
Right now I'm wearing a ring, but I'm also wearing a necklace, which is from our Vito collection, and it includes sapphires and diamonds, and one bangle and one bracelet also. Lots of sparkly diamonds.
Sounds great, Laura. That's Laura Chavez. She is from Lark and Berry, and she's co-founded a fast-growing laboratory-grown diamond company called Lark and Berry. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.